Thank you for listening to this lesson presented by Reverend Millage Mosby. We affirm that this lesson has inspired and uplifted you and given you practical tools you can use to divinely guide you in every aspect of your life. We give thanks that as a listener of our online Sunday lessons, you are open to donating to support this web ministry. Please click on the donate button and follow your inner guidance. Thank you, and we continue to hold you in the light.
So before we get started, I just want to emphasize the point that this spiritual process as we are approaching it is way more than what we have ever learned in our previous church experiences, possibly. And the more I read about it and study the other traditions, what we talk about in unity is really not unity principles. It's universal principles that Charles and Myrtle Fillmore, you know, grasped onto and pulled into this, you know, this tradition. And it's so much more than this idea of being good. You've heard me say this several times before that, you know, when we're trying to be good, basically what we're doing is we're trying to be good according to our perception of what that is. This is more about becoming an instrument or a channel through which the good can flow. So we're moving more from being, an ego instrument makes these decisions based on our perceptions to being an open instrument, as it says, Lord, make me an instrument of thy peace. So that, based on that, the thinking we need to evolve to understand how to get to that level is just so way beyond what we typically think it is, right? And then, you know, we talk about today, Palm Sunday. Now, you have to look at Palm Sunday and Easter as symbolic of a process. You get what I'm saying? So, yes, it may be it happened in history, but we want to look at it more. What is the symbolism behind it? And to start off with a quote from Martha Smock that's in the Lent booklet, she says, "You are unfettered, unbound, triumphant, glorious, free." All right, let me say that again. You are unfettered, unbound, triumphant, glorious, free. And basically, she's stating a truth that we may not yet realize within ourselves, okay? Because right now we feel fettered, bound, not simply triumphant, and not necessarily glorious and free, you know, because we can say, well, this is going on, that's going on, okay? She's saying, beyond all of that, that's the perception of the ego. Beyond all of that, you are unfettered, unbound, triumphant, glorious, free. Okay, and in this lesson, we're going to explore how and why that statement is true for every one of us. So this is the day that Jesus made a triumphant ride into Jerusalem. And the Lent booklet explains the metaphysical meaning of Jerusalem is the place in our consciousness where we find peace and a sense of being whole in mind, body, and spirit. All right, so again, Jerusalem is a geographical place, but metaphysically is a state of consciousness. Okay. And Jerusalem represents our spiritual consciousness, or in the context of what we have been studying, it's the path we take to spiritual awakening. I'm awake, right? Now, you heard me say before, the ones we know about are Buddha and Jesus, who said, I'm awake. But when you start studying Eastern philosophy and Eastern history, you find so many masters who have awakened. You get what I'm saying? You know, so they don't have the same press that Buddha and Jesus God, right? The same what personal relations agent, I guess it is. But there are so many masters who have awakened to the truth of their being. Right? So the Lenten journey is leading us to Calvary. Again, Calvary is a geographical place, but it's also a state of consciousness. And it says, leading us to Calvary in the experience on the cross. So all of us, the lifetime experience is getting to that cross, and we're going to work to understand what that means. And we know what we learned from studying Jesus' journey to Calvary is that it seems the real struggle began for him in the Garden of Gethsemane. And you know, it's really fascinating. Many years ago, I had a Bible program that only worked up to like Windows 95 or something, and I was really disappointed when I couldn't get it on my new put it on my new computer. But I work with three monitors, and this monitor is Google. And Now it's like way beyond that Bible program. You just Google and you get massive amount of information on history and deeper understanding about what these things mean, you know. So this idea of the Garden of Gethsemane, the Metaphysical Bible Dictionary explains Gethsemane as symbolizes a struggle that takes place within our consciousness when we realize that truth is our one reality, okay? And then, you know, being in Gethsemane represents the struggle we go through when we begin to realize that the typical thoughts of our ego mind are completely out of sync with those of our Christ or spiritual mind, okay? And the key is, I think even many of us here in the study have gotten to a place where we're beginning to say, you know, what I think about this that's happening in my life is really not in sync with my Christ mind, my higher consciousness. Does that make sense? Okay. And so you struggle with, do I let myself get wrapped up in these emotions or do I try to rise above that? And it almost seems unrealistic, you know, to try to rise above the stuff that you're struggling with. Because all of our lives, the thing to do is to be in the mix. You're right. And now we're saying, how do I rise out of the mix? Okay. So this is where our personal self is in conflict with our spiritual self, sort of like re-explaining the dark night of the soul. Has anybody ever done any reading on the dark night of the soul? Okay, so in the whole idea of the dark night of the soul, St. John of the Cross going through the dark night of the soul, it's funny, many of you said you have not read about it, but every one of us have gone through it. Maybe going through it. Okay, the dark night of the soul. Or in my studies of the Bhagavad Gita, that's all that that's about. The whole Bhagavad Gita is all about the struggle of you heard me say, Arjuna, who's the main character, is in battle. He's in a war all the time. And the armies that are coming at him are all the things in his ego are saying, no, we don't want you to go to Krishna, which is the Christ. That's the whole story of the Gita. You know, that he's in a fight, a battle, a war. And that's what happens to us. Every time we try to say, well, you know, I'm going to try to step out of this dynamic that I used to do, that dynamic becomes an army that's fighting you and saying, no, we're not letting you go. You get the process? So that's why I'm saying it's all, you know, this idea of becoming spiritual is archetypical. An archetype is something in our consciousness that was implanted within every human being. How do I evolve out of this struggle that I'm in? So the Garden of Gethsemane represents for each one of us that place where a tremendous shift in consciousness occurs from thinking based on fear and judgment and the spiritual ignorance of our ego self to the thinking based on faith, love, and the wisdom of our spiritual self. That's the shift that we're seeking to make. And this shift occurs from diligently doing the work necessary to establish a divine connection with the truth of our being. And this is the purpose of the Lent journey. We're seeking to create a divine connection. So every time you spend time in prayer and meditation, and I'm not talking about prayer where you're asking for stuff, okay? I'm talking about prayer where you're trying to create a divine union. So even if there's a struggle in your life, the prayer to create a divine union is to put you into a state of consciousness that's higher than that stuff you're struggling with, all right? So, and all of us know what that looks like because you can look back over your life and say, boy, was I struggling in that time of my life, but I'm not there anymore. You're above it. That's why you're not struggling. Does that make sense? Okay. So the garden represents our spiritual body. It represents a place in consciousness from which we will be capable of bringing forth thoughts patterned after original divine ideas. And let me say it again. So the garden represents a place in consciousness from which we'll be capable of bringing forth thoughts patterned after original divine ideas. So many of the ideas that we get are not in their original form. And what we have a tendency to do is that the idea is formulating, we pluck it from the tree and say, oh, this is mine. And we usually pluck it before it's ripe. You get it? Because the ego wants to be able to say what? I came up with this. Okay? And that's the idea of becoming an instrument where you no longer represent, it is not I, but the Father within me that does this great work. See, that's Jesus, right? So to be able to enter the garden takes tremendous preparation to establish a new way of thinking and a new perspective, a new way of understanding who am I truly, all right? And I can't think of the guy's name now, but he says, you're not all that exists between your hat and your boots. There's much more to you than that, okay? And this requires a shift in the way we mentally and emotionally process our life experiences. See, stuff happens, and the ego right away says, oh, this is good. Oh, this is bad, right? And so we have this way of processing by categorizing what's happening in our lives. So how do we prepare ourselves to enter the Garden of Gethsemane, this transformative experience? Well, it requires a tremendous shift in our mental emotional diet, which begins by fasting. Here's the hard part: fasting from things that are making us angry, upset, okay? Being unforgiving, all those things that we do that the mind says, whoa, you know, this, I'm going to go to this thing that I always do in that situation. How do I fast from that? Does that make sense? Okay, so you're making this tremendous shift from thinking that it's not of faith, not of peace, not of love, not of joy, you know, and all those other things that we do that put us under the idea of fear. So all of, remember, if you're not operating from love, you're operating from fear. And see, when we're operating from fear, we can justify it and rationalize it and say, ooh, and everybody else goes, oh, yeah, you got full right to feel like that. Okay? And so we kind of orchestrate ourselves into that idea. Love is a whole other dynamic. And we're talking about unconditional love. Now, so, you know, can you comprehend the seemingly insurmountable nature of the task of purely operating from love? Unconditional love. Boy, we have so many reasons. The army would come at us and say, no, you can't do it in this situation. Okay? And just like, you know, the purpose of the physical fast is to cleanse the body of old dead cells to make a healthy environment for healthy cells to thrive and resurrect our body, the purpose of fasting from negative thoughts, feelings, and emotions is to create a peaceful environment in which we can resurrect a new state of consciousness filled with faith, love, divine wisdom, divine order, and compassionate understanding. So the thing is, I can't come from a spiritual mindset as I am. Right? So, you know, when you fast, if you have an addiction to something, like, say, sugar or whatever it might be, when you fast from it, your body, because it's filled with it, is calling for more of it. But when you fast long enough to cleanse that from your system, then the body no longer craves it. You get what I'm saying? And right now, as you're trying to be spiritual, but we're filled with all this fear-based mentality, your body's craving more fear. So how can you take on and embrace spiritual ideology when you're filled with all this other stuff? Does that make sense? Okay, so it's sort of a process where you have to create a void, and God will not allow a void, all right? And so it will fill it with itself. But it can't fill it with itself when you're full of other stuff. Which goes back to, you know, I've said this 1,000 times, when Joseph and Mary, wisdom and love, showed up at the inn with giving the one to give birth to the Christ, the people at the inn said, oh, I'm sorry, there's no more room. But you got to be careful. He said, there's no more room for you. There's no more room for peace and love and understand. Because we got room, so they go away, and people come up, you know, fill up other ideas, and then they say, oh, yeah, we got room for you. And that's what our mind does. So what happens is that you're in a situation, and love comes and knocks on the door and says, no, let me come in. I will help you with this. You say, oh, I got no room for you. Because my mind is filled with the thought people that are making me upset and angry. Does that, you get it? Okay. And that's really the interest. That's what people miss in Scripture, that there's no more room for you, Joseph and Mary, wisdom and love, bringing the Christ child. But we got plenty of room for all these other folks. Okay. So, and that's what that's the sort of the mechanics of the thinking as you are processing this for yourself, you know. So anyway, you know, the Lenten journey prepares us for the crucifixion of our old ego self with its tendency to be intrigued by and addicted to fear and its many components, so as to make way for the resurrection of the new self, free of addiction, free of fear, and only inspired by love. Okay. Now, this is a journey that we've all been destined to take. When we came into this experience, this is the journey we were here to take. Does everybody follow me? Okay. I had my brother asked me if I wanted to do a astrological reading. I don't really know much about that, but the guy he hooked me up with does it for all of the people in Hollywood and everywhere. Okay, and so I said, okay, you know, it's all on phone, and it comes all up on your computer screen, graphs. He used the Vedantic and all this stuff that he, you know, brings up. But the thing that was interesting is he was talking about how when you're born, there's a point you're born, when you first come out, you might not be breathing, and then, you know, they cut the umbilical cord and you start breathing. At that point, he says, when the soul and spirit enters into the body. Okay? And when the soul and spirit enters into the body, it's entering into the body with the decision that I'm here to evolve to the next level of consciousness through this body. That's a powerful thought, isn't it? And he really was emphasizing the fact that we are, you can say it with me, spiritual beings having a physical experience. He kept saying that to me, and I said, well, yeah, I've already... But what I'm saying is it's fascinating. And then, you know, I don't know if you saw, Oprah, who was talking to a college group, you know, graduating group. And she first right off the bat, she says, I want you to know you're spiritual beings having a human experience. So what I want you to get understand is that this is not just Unity saying this. It's in all sciences and different traditions and so forth, okay? But this is the journey that we were destined to take, meaning the study, the sacrifice, the ritual we go through in preparation for Easter is symbolic of the journey we came here to take. It is our spiritual destiny to take action by moving forward, to make the journey to Calvary, to place in our consciousness where we will make a complete shift from fear to faith by crossing out and making room for the other. So the cross, the idea of the cross, and there's way more to this symbolism that I'm saying. The idea of the cross is where you cross out that old thinking to make room for new thinking. Okay, and in this shift from fear to faith, in order for it to occur, something substantial must take place within us, which is symbolic or symbolized by Jesus' experience on the cross. And you know, everybody in this room, I bet you, if we went around the room, could talk about an extreme experience that completely changed your life. Am I right? Okay. And so on a mini scale is what Jesus was demonstrating on a large scale. Okay. So what occurred at the cross at Calvary was that Jesus' personal will was crucified, crossed out, overcome, so that the Christ, truth, could become the dominant force in the forefront of our minds. Now, I'm going to explain more about the forefront of our minds a little later. All right, so simply Jesus' personal will, my will, was diminished so that the Christ, thy will, could become the full expression within him. And again, where do we see that? John the Baptist says, I must decrease so that he can increase. Okay? I must increase. That's something we have to, so when stuff happens in our lives, we got to say, you know, I got to start letting go of that. I have to let go. And what comes after that? Let God. Okay? Let go and let God be God in me. So after the crucifixion and resurrection experience, there was no personal will to resist the full expression of the Christ within Jesus. So Jesus became fully conscious of the truth of the Christ within him. That was what we talked about, changed the order of his name from Jesus Christ to Christ Jesus. It symbolizes his allowing the divinity, Christ, to embrace and rise up the personality, Jesus, to a new state of awareness. So we're not just talking about destroying the ego. It says in Scripture, the Son of Man must be lifted up to the Son of God. So, you know, a lot of people, I've heard people say, well, when I become spiritual, I still know who I am? Right? Right? And that's the ego talking. It said, I'm afraid of losing who I am. Okay? So it's not about destroying the ego. It's about helping the ego understand its true role is not to be the dominant force, but to be the instrument. Okay? That's the idea behind it. So for us, the crossing out experience occurs as we loosen our attachment to our persona, the mask we choose to hide behind. You've heard me talk about that before. Now, the Swiss psychiatrist Carl Jung explains The prasanna is a compromise between the actual perception of ourself and the many selves we choose to express in our varied relationships. Let me say that again. The prasanna is a compromise between the actual perception of ourself and the many selves we choose to express in our varied relationships, right? So every time we go into a different, wait, pop. Oh, that's so, let me pop this mask up. It's like, you've seen the commercial, right, where the lady holds a mask in front of her, all right? And that's what we do. We keep popping masks up, all right? Because we really don't want people to see what? The real self, okay, with its soul secrets, as Ed Rabel used to say. And yes, it is true that in many instances it seems necessary to wear these many personas in order to negotiate our way through life, right? All right, so I mean, you get in certain situations, you go, well, I don't want this person to see how I really am, so I just pop this one on. All right, and it gets me through this situation. Does that make sense? You see what I mean? And to the ego, saying, yeah, I got to do that. I need all these masks. All right, and so, but listen to what it says in Awakening. This is a book called Awakening the Buddhist Heart. The author explains the persona becomes problematic and limiting when it becomes so fixed that it causes us to become frozen in place. The persona becomes problematic when it doesn't allow for growth or authentic feelings, when it insulates us and acts like a shell of armor. And many of us are fixed in a certain mindset. You know, the idea, oh, I'm too old to change. You're never too old to change until you're pushing up daisies, right? Right? Now, he goes on to say that the fixed persona is a stumbling block to our spiritual path. What we haven't been able to grasp yet is how our attachment to a role, I like this, a role, a look or image can stand in the way of our inner search for a divine connection to God. We become so outer-directed that it actually prevents us from becoming inner-directed. So in other words, we step out and it's like, you know, I've got this certain way that people think about me, you know, that I like, the ideal other, if you remember my real other, ideal and ideal other, the ideal other, and I don't want people to see anything different, all right? And so we get stuck in that thing of trying to always, you know, show these different roles. So the author says, what we need to understand is that the personas that we create are tightly wrapped up in the stories we tell ourselves about who we are. In short, we often use our persona as an unquestionable reason to cling to our ego. I need to be like this. But when we take off the armor and discard bits and pieces of our persona, we also let go of our ego's need to cling to its perceptions, and this will help to loosen us up from this idea of me, my, mine thinking that we adequately indulge in. Most of the things that go on in our lives is all about me. You get it? Okay? And just one more, you know, quote from the author from this book, The Awakening Buddhist Heart. He says, when we release and drop our attachments to our persona-driven images, whether those images are represented by appearance or possession or status or role or attitude, we come closer to our true authentic self, our true inner Christ self. I had a dream this morning. I touched Pam. I said, Pam, I think it's time to get up. And we both went right back to sleep. Right. And in that time, I had this dream, which I have a lot, that I'm supposed to be talking, doing my Sunday talk. I'm in my house clothes, which is my plaid pajama-looking pants and my sweatshirt, which I always wear when I'm at home. And I'm running, and I'm in this building, and the building is multi-stories high, and there were kids on every floor. And I kept going from floor to floor looking for a quiet place. And, you know, when I got to the top and I finally found a quiet place, and I was looking, I had a bunch of papers in my hand, and as I was moving through them, none of the papers had my talk in it. So I was freaking out because I didn't have the, and I couldn't run all the way back all down the stairs to go find it. And then I realized it was almost time to give the talk, and I was still in my, you know, my pajama look, hadn't shaved or nothing. You know I got a beard, but I got to shave all up here, right? Right? You know? And I'm like panicked because I wasn't going to have the look and be prepared. You get what I'm saying? Okay. So that's that idea. The ego is in there saying, no, you know, you got to get yourself together before you do that. So it's like being okay with coming up here. I have to do that one time to see how it works. You know, just talk off the top of my head, right? Yeah, okay. But you get the point, right, of how we want to show up, that's really important to us, you know. So, you know, Jesus' life is a lesson that we go along in humility, in surrender, that's led by, you know, leads you to true glory and power. True glory and power is when you're no longer attached to those personas. You get it? It's like came across Rome, the one who wrote, "Lord, make me an instrument of your peace." St. Francis. St. Francis is, you know, walking down the road, and he comes across Rumi. You've heard of Rumi, right? So Rumi is spinning, you know, the whirling dervish. He's spinning in the road. And so St. Francis goes up to him and starts spinning with him. Instead of saying, "Why are you doing that?" You know, he just starts spinning with him. He says, "Well, let me just get in groove with this guy." And they're both spinning. And then after a while, he says, "Well, brother, why are we doing this?" Okay? But in other words, he didn't stand off and judge him and say, "What is wrong with you? Out here in the middle of nowhere and you're just standing and spinning in the road?" He joined him. Do you get the point? Okay? And what we do a lot of times, we stand off, we just judge and says, "What is wrong with you?" Okay? So that's sort of, and again, while we're sitting here saying this, the ego is going, "Yeah, well, that's the right thing to do." Right? See, so that's what I mean, the struggle of getting, I always say the ego can't jump out of the ego. You know, it's hard not to be who we are. You know, and at present, most of us are mesmerized by the dramatic perceptions of our personal self. Mesmerized by it, all right? We're entrenched in what we believe to be our reality, captivated by our own perceptions of how we think things ought to be and how people ought to be in order for our world to be okay, okay? But in the life and teachings of Jesus, we find methodology. Basically, we find practical techniques for everyday living that we can use to unravel ourselves from the outer circumstances we now believe are our barometer for our happiness and move into a place of just being. Just being. All right? And it's written in the Metaphysical Dictionary that, and this is what I was talking about, the forefront of the mind, that the seat of our conscious mind is in the front of our brain. And there our will, our ego, has established its dominion. It is through this gateway in the front of our brain that everything affecting our body and our lives is admitted or rejected based on our personal or individual perceptions. Even spiritual truth has to be admitted through the door before it can become part of the consciousness. It is that there that the ego will must be crossed out or removed as the gatekeeper of our mind to give the divine, the Christ, free expression within us. Now, in the marketing book that I use at the college, they talk about this concept, and they talk about the gatekeeper in the marketing book. It looks right here, and you know who knows about it? Marketers. They know they got to get past that gatekeeper in order to get the ideas they want you to, you know, to take in past that gatekeeper. And you know how when you're kind of confused or whatever, you kind of do like this, you know, right? And so what's happening, you're kind of like to massage that area and trying to get it to straighten up, okay? And so that gatekeeper, every one of us has a different gatekeeper depending on how our life experience has been. All the way back from early childhood, we developed that gatekeeper, okay? So now when we're hearing these spiritual principles, you know, we're hearing them and say, "Oh, that sounds good." But it depends on whether or not the gatekeeper is letting that through as to whether that's going to have any effect in our lives. Otherwise, it just becomes stuff that we know. That makes sense? Okay. And that's the metaphysical explanation of this Lenten journey. And what we have studied in the past few weeks is similar to what Moses learned on his journey to open up the eye of his soul. You know, Moses, you know, he's in the wilderness for 40 years, right? And so that 40 years represents what? The time it took for him to be ready and open for some significant change in his life. So, you know, he gets this burning bush experience, but this is what he was being taught by God. He was being taught by God that by yourself, you are not enough. But if you will turn to God and ask God for help, you will receive the guidance you need to get through any challenge. Trust God and trust the divine process working within you. Worship God only and continuously strive not to fall prey to fear, cynicism, and doubt. By myself, I am not enough. Now, in the whole, you know, self-motivation thing, we were taught, I'm it. Okay? But if you go back to the charts, you know, Maslow's hierarchy, physiological needs, safety needs, loving, belonging needs, self-esteem, self-actualization. Self-actualization is where I have created this. You know, there's a new chart out. There's new charts out now that are above that. And the top is transcendence. See, so you move from I have done all this to transcendence, which is I haven't done any of this. Transcendence, when you realize this has all been done through me. You get it? Okay? So these are the lessons that, if followed, will lead to a spiritual awakening, which will lead to Christ consciousness. So in our study over the years, it should be clear that we cannot remain as we are and at the same time evolve to be spiritual. You can't. All right? So our mission is to reposition our personal self, our personal will, in its relationship to our indwelling Christ, which, again, is what Jesus was referring to in John 3:14 when he said, the Son of Man must be lifted up to the Son of God. All right? The Son of Man is a stage of development in our consciousness where we are capable of discerning the difference between truth and error, love and fear, God and ego. And at this stage of consciousness, we're in a position to free ourselves from the fear-based thinking that creates dis-ease in our body and our mind. So all this stuff that we're going to the doctor for, yes, materia medica, is part of the divine universe saying, well, this is where you are. It's back to Moses throwing the tablets down and breaking them because he says, whoa, the way they are, the way God gave them to me, there's no way these people are going to understand this. They threw it down and broke them. So materia medica, the whole medical profession, is where, but you can heal yourself. But the universe says, yeah, they don't know that yet. So I give materia medica. So materia medica is good, right? Because it's good because that's where we are at this particular time. All right, it's like I was explaining to my chiropractor how when I had this shoulder replaced, they gave me that Oxycontin or whatever. What is it? Is that Oxycontin? I didn't take none of that. Right? And he said, well, how did you get through it? I said, ice. Well, it was more than ice. He said, my whole being was like, I'm not taking that. All right? And because my whole being was tapped into it, my body gave me, I had pain, but it was pain that I could live with. Does that make sense? Okay? So that's the whole thing. But if it's like, nah, man, I ain't want no pain. Give me all them drugs. Right? If that's your mentality, then the universe says, okay, well, that's where you are, but I provided for that. You get it? Okay? So, again, to be fair, we have a lot. I like this. So to be fair, we have a lot of karmic energy that we have to work through. All right? Now, remember I told you that when you have those really good meditations, and all of a sudden you come out and you go, oh, wow, I wish I could have stayed in that meditation. The reason why you can't stay in the meditation is because you have karma you have to work out. Once, like Maharishi and these other great masters, they can stay in that state of mind forever because they've worked out all their karma. You get what I'm saying? See, we want to go into that and go, oh, man, it's nice in here. I don't want to, it's like being in the Bahamas, laying on the beach. I don't want to go back. It's snowing back there, So it's sort of like that thing, but you have to go back because you got stuff you got to do. Does that make sense? Okay. So, as we read in John 1:17, grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. Grace and truth came through Jesus Christ, meaning grace is sort of like an antidote to karma. You ever heard that before? I knew you haven't because I just made it up. Grace is an antidote to karma. Because again, karma is stuff that in your life you got to work out, all right? But grace raises you to a level of consciousness that when that karmic energy comes through, what goes around comes around. When it comes back around, you're no longer at that level of consciousness. Now, you can't play with grace by saying, whoa, here it comes, grace, lift me up. And then when it comes, you put me back down, right? It's a whole shift in consciousness. Now, Deepak Chopra gives us 5 steps to cleanse ourselves of negative karma. You ready? Okay. Number one, be grateful for every experience, good or not good. Ooh. Well, we can be grateful for the good ones, but we don't want those not so good ones. But there's lessons in everything. There was a African American billionaire. I can't think of his name because I'd never heard him before. I just showed him the thing to my class, and he was talking about. I've never heard of this guy before, but he's a billionaire, owns 75 companies that he started, and the guy said that people have the misconception of failure. He said failure or the bad things that happen to you, so-called bad, he said that is where you get your richest experiences from, your richest information about who and what you really are and how you can function in situations like that. He said if everything's going good, like I forgot who the guy's name is, Peter Drucker said about Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak that God was not fair to them because he let them go from their garage to a $6 billion business in 5 years with no mistakes. And, of course, Steve Jobs got fired from Apple, right, during that time. See, so the stuff that we go through that we call not good is still good. That's why he said the number one is be grateful. Number two, act with love towards everyone no matter what they have done. Yeah, okay. Number three, check your motives and make sure that they come from a place of love for yourself and for others. Why am I doing this? What is my motive? Number four, watch your attitude because negative thoughts create angry energy towards yourself. Right? And number five, be forgiving. Because even though it can be the hardest thing to do, it can have the greatest impact on changing your karmic energy. All right? Which one? Number four? Number four was watch your attitude. Okay, and number five is be forgiving. Really powerful stuff. So Jesus understood the difficulty of the process of moving from my will to thy will. We knew he understood the difficulty of it because he fell to the ground and said, Father, let this cup pass from me, comma, not my will, thine be done. Okay, and this is why he continued to work on himself until he was ready to complete the crucifixion, or the removal from dominance of his personal will so that nothing would prevent him from totally integrating his mind with Christ's mind. So he had to go through the work, all right? Now, I think the piece we're still missing is that we do not understand how much work and commitment is required for the process of transformation. It is a day-by-day, moment-by-moment process working to let go of old stuff to make room for the new. You cannot fill, it's like old. Can I fill old wineskins with new wine? Because it would cause it to burst. So even if you could get this spiritual energy within you, if you had not prepared yourself for it, it would cause problems. All right. So we're working on emptying ourselves, and this is one of the main reasons why it's important to come together often, together like this, in spiritual communion with others. Yes, you can listen to it on the internet, okay? But you don't get the energy of other people. You know, it's like, when I go to the gym in the morning, and you go there, and yes, I got weights and stuff at home, but when you go to the gym, I see other people like myself, who are there, they're diligent. All of us have been coming to that gym for over 30 years, and they're still there. Carol is 80 years old. I was saying to Pam, and she's still doing the same workout, and she still looks the same. All right? And so that communion of people who care about their fitness is wonderful. I mean, Charles and Bernadette, it's one thing listening to you on a CD, but it's a whole other thing and being in your space. It's organic, as Gary said. It's a whole other thing. So you come to church because you want to feel the energy of the other people who are on the same path that you're on, as opposed to sitting at home. Like one of my colleagues who's young, 38, that's young, right? she's PhD. She says to me, I just have it going on over here while I'm doing this over here. It's just, you're just taking in information. It's not doing anything to really inspire you. All right, so I think it's a process we have to work on every single day. Now, the reading from a past Science of Mind magazine back in 2016 said the real self is God-given and cannot be denied. It is a place within each of us where God comes to a point of individualized and personalized expression. Let me say that again. I like that. It is a place within each of us where God comes to a point of individualized and personalized expression. It is when we reach that point where we can truly say, I and the Father are one. So now we're going to, hopefully we understand a little bit better about this journey, but we're going to end with the same affirmation that we started with. I am unfettered, unbound, triumphant, glorious, free. I am unfettered,
unbound,
glorious, free. One more time. I am unfettered, unbound, triumphant, glorious, free. Amen. All right.